wisdom is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, April 28th, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
The collapse of the auto industry, AIG executives' obscene bonuses, and the collusion of the financial news media in the second of a four-part special on the best of Uprising's economic coverage. This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Gabrielle and I are off this week, and so Monday through Thursday, we're bringing you a reprise of the best of our economic coverage this year. Today, we'll begin by hearing about the AIG executive bonuses, just as Congress was taking up the issue. Edward Liddy, the embattled CEO of AIG, is testifying at a House Financial Services Subcommittee hearing this morning. Members of Congress and the Obama administration are falling over themselves this week to denounce the $165 million in bonuses for top executives at AIG. The corporation in question received $170 billion in bailout funds last year. The government now owns an 80% stake in the company as a result. Company executives have defended the bonuses, saying that they were contractually obligated to pay them out, and that such incentives are required to retain top talent. Now, a few members of Congress, like Senator Chris Dodd, have proposed a narrow tax designed to recoup the majority of these bonuses if they're not paid back to the government voluntarily. Meanwhile, some institutions that benefited from the most recent bailout, such as Citigroup and Morgan Stanley, are apparently looking for ways to get around the caps on bonuses that were a condition of the money by trying to raise base salaries for top executives. Some smaller banks have offered to pay the government back rather than put up with the restrictions on executive pay. Here is what President Obama said about the AIG bonuses on Monday.
This is a corporation that finds itself in financial distress due to recklessness and greed. Under these circumstances, it's hard to understand how derivative traders at AIG warranted any bonuses, much less $165 million in extra pay. I mean, how do they justify this outrage to the taxpayers who are keeping the company afloat? In the last 6 months, AIG has received substantial sums from the U.S. Treasury. And I've asked Secretary Geithner to use that leverage and pursue every single legal avenue to block these bonuses and make the American taxpayers whole.
President Obama speaking on Monday about the AIG bonuses and the scandal surrounding it. Well, that scandal has not let up yet. My guest this morning to discuss what's going on and to help put it in perspective are Sarah Anderson, director of the Global Economy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, and Stephen Lerner, special assistant to SEIU President Andy Stern. Welcome to Uprising, Sarah and Stephen.
Great to be here.
Good to be here.
Thanks very much for joining us. Now, Sarah, let me start with you. President Obama said his Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner, is going to be pursuing all legal avenues to stop these bonuses. But in the end, it seems as though he is saying his hands are tied. Do you think that this Treasury Secretary is really doing everything he can?
Well, it's hard to tell, but as you mentioned, several members of Congress are jumping into action here. I've seen descriptions of six different proposals to recoup those bonuses through special taxes. And so I think they are really feeling the heat. I was just listening to the opening statements in the hearing today where the CEO of AIG will be speaking, and they're all sort of falling over each other, trying to outdo themselves on the rhetoric. You know, once you've said morally reprehensible and unconscionable, call 10 times, it's almost hard to know what to say about AIG. And one testimony I was really moved by was Representative Gary Peters from Michigan, who said, hey, I have constituents who are UAW members who were told they had to renegotiate their employment contracts in order to justify taxpayer money.
And that's a really important point.
How come the auto workers had to do it and these finance guys don't have to do it? And so this is a really serious issue, and I'm hoping the Obama administration can get out ahead of it, because I'm worried it could undermine the credibility of the administration.
Now, Stephen Lerner, that's a very good point that Sarah just brought up, and I think it brings into stark relief, this whole controversy brings into stark relief, although you wouldn't know it by reading a mainstream media, that the fundamental problem existed before the recession, this enormous disparity between ordinary employees, workers, factory workers, manufacturing workers, and just most ordinary Americans' jobs and these corporate CEOs.
Yeah, what's extraordinary is the excess that people are seeing now with the bonuses is the tip of the iceberg, and it's morally grotesque. But the greater problem is that the basic business model the finance companies operate under is how do you get average people in more and more debt and then collect fees from them. So their entire business model is at the root of the economic crisis, which is why tomorrow we have demonstrations going on in, I think, up to 150 cities around the country protesting not just AIG, but calling for the reform of the financial system, which ranges from we need health care reform, we need to deal with the debt that these guys are putting consumers in as a business model, and we also need to stop the banks we're financing from fighting the Employee Free Choice Act, which is a way that workers can start to be paid and treated decently.
And that's a really important point. You also don't hear in the mainstream media. I wonder if it will be brought up at the hearing today. And I will give out the information for the demonstration that's happening in L.A. as part of the SEIU's efforts in just a moment. But Sarah Anderson, going back to the point about renegotiating contracts, I mean, one of the main arguments that AIG is giving is that these were contracts that were put in place before the bailout monies were given. And these were contracts that cannot, you know, that they're legally bound by. What if AIG had been allowed to fail? Wouldn't a bankruptcy court, for example, have nullified all these employee contracts?
Apparently, there is something complicated about bankruptcy procedures that wouldn't have applied to AIG. It's a very technical issue, but I think we are in a crisis here that requires creative thinking, and that's why I think the taxes on the bonuses are a good route to go. But we also do need to take advantage of this moment, as Steve said, to get at the bigger problems with the system. The problems with excessive pay are not just with the bailout companies. It's a system-wide problem that has encouraged the reckless behavior that got us into this crisis. And so we're hoping that at this moment we can push for proposals that apply to all companies. Representative Barbara Lee is introducing a bill today that would cap the tax deductibility of executive pay at all firms, so taxpayers would no longer be subsidizing excessive executive pay. And so I'm hoping that in this crisis we can see some opportunities for some broader reforms that will put a bit more sanity back into the system.
And Sarah, the standard argument given to justify this obscene pay is that's what's needed to retain top talent. And in fact, AIG themselves are saying even now that this entire scandal over the compensation is scaring away some of their top talent, some of the very people who are most intimately knowledgeable about the financial crisis, perhaps because they helped create it, and that they're being scared away. How do you respond?
I'm impressed that you were able to deliver their argument without bursting out laughing.
I'm holding back.
You did a really good job. I mean, that is absolutely backwards logic. We'd all be better off if these people had never been in those jobs. I mean, it would almost make more sense to pay them to leave. Let's have expulsion pay, get rid of these guys, rather than retaining them as if they are somehow, this top talent that we couldn't, get along without. I mean, it's just just laughable in the argument that they're being heavily recruited by other companies. I mean, what other companies? Every company out there is having mass layoffs. It's just absolutely absurd.
I mean, this would be a time when I would imagine just having a steady job with a decent salary would be an asset. I can imagine that a lot of these financial consultants and executives are thankful to have the job they have, notwithstanding the bonus. Stephen Lerner, this same argument seems to not hold up to people in power, both government and corporations, when you apply to ordinary workers, say when you apply to teachers or other workers, that higher salaries can help to attract talent.
Well, what's extraordinary, just take Bank of America. They gave, through Merrill Lynch, the $4 billion in bonuses. If you had instead divided that money up among their tellers who make like $10 an hour and don't have affordable health insurance, it would have been either close to $15,000 a year in a bonus per worker. So we have this crazy logic, which is the people that got us into trouble get rewarded, and then people that work in the banks themselves have to go get Medicare money because from the state because they're not paid enough to provide health insurance for their families. So the whole thing is so out of whack, which is why we think part of the solution here is we have to pass the Employee Free Choice Act and make other changes as we're fixing the financial system. That means workers really have a voice and a say, or otherwise they'll find a new way around whatever regulation we pass to, again, sort of suck the money to the top while forcing workers out of the middle class and into poverty.
The SEIU has helped organize a demonstration. Well, there's demonstrations happening around the country tomorrow, Thursday, March 19th, in Los Angeles, in front of the AIG headquarters in Century City. There's going to be a gathering at 5 p.m. to protest the bonuses. That's 1999 Avenue of the Stars in L.A. tomorrow at 5 p.m. There's more information at takebacktheeconomy.org. So let's talk a little bit about other corporations. Sarah Anderson, it's not just AIG. I mentioned Citigroup and Morgan Stanley. There are other companies that received bailout funds last year and earlier this year that have already paid out excessive amounts of money to their top CEOs. How come they're not feeling the heat?
It is a bit bewildering to me, because this to me is just the scandal of the day. It's just the latest example of this Marie Antoinette syndrome on Wall Street, where these guys have just been living in this bubble that has them completely disconnected with the reality of this crisis. I mean, just I think a week or two ago, I was doing the same interviews. I probably used that same line talking about Merrill Lynch, where they gave top executives more than $10 million. In cash and stock. This should not be news. And we said back in the fall when they passed the original bailout that the restrictions on executive pay had to be much tighter. And people used arguments like, oh, well, come on, these banks don't have any money. There's no way they'll continue to hand out such massive paychecks. I mean, I knew all along that the shame factor has no impact on these kinds of people who've been living in this bubble. And the time is to legislate an end to the bailout profiteering. I'm hoping that Congress finally is waking up. I mean, I've been saying, you know, taxpayers might get their pitchforks out. I thought I was being rhetorical, and now AIG is saying they're being inundated with death threats. So this is serious, and I'm hoping we're going to see some real action.
And Stephen Lerner, on that same issue with some of these just obscene bonuses that have already been paid out that we, you know, can't do anything about or seemingly can't do anything about at this point, you know, other countries, Britain and other European countries that had these similar bailout packages for their corporations put strings on them to begin with. I'm not sure specifically if they addressed CEO bonuses, but why is it that here in the United States we shied away? I mean, is it just this overwhelming culture of, you know, not interfering in the market, quote unquote?
Well, it's interesting. I think in the UK, they actually fired most of the people that ran the banks when the government bailed them out. It wasn't even that they restricted the pay. And so I do think there's been this bizarre worship that these guys are magicians and they have a secret knowledge, and if we got rid of them, we wouldn't know what to do. We've come out and think Ken Lewis from the Bank of America, who's their shareholders meeting's coming up on April 29th, we think he should be fired. We think it's not just a matter of limiting their pay. They need to be gotten rid of. They got us in this mess. And what's happening all around the country. We have not just in San Francisco. In San Francisco, we'll be at AIG and Wells Fargo at noon. We're going to be at Cisco. We're seeing an explosion of people saying that we need to physically take action and we need to raise all the issues to, and seize this moment to say it's their bonuses, it's their business model, it's a system that rewards cheating and greed and punishes people who work for a living. And I think we're at a very exciting time where people are going to call folks on this, and we can make the kind of systemic change we need to start fixing the economy.
But sadly, the mainstream media are not making the connections that you and Sarah are making, which is that this is a systemic problem throughout the business model that's been adopted over the last several decades, that it's not just AIG, and it's not just the fact that they use the bailout funds, that it's, you know, even if it wasn't the bailout funds, that it's this kind of corporate greed, this obscene disparity in income in this country. And I'm wondering, you know, these connections aren't necessarily being made. And I want to ask both of you, you know, this is something that's being cast sometimes as a Democrats versus Republicans issue, that Republicans are gleefully, looking at this scandal as a way to see Barack Obama's stimulus package fail. The Democrats are scrambling to try to salvage some of it. But really, is it a Democrats versus Republicans issue, or is it just sort of a people versus corporations issue?
Well, I tell you, listening to the opening statements in the hearing today, I couldn't distinguish between Republicans and Democrats. Everyone was talking about people, ordinary people suffering in their districts while these guys on Wall Street are, you know, laughing all the way to the bank. And so I think that it could be a real unifying issue across the political spectrum. And I really applaud Steve for what his organization is doing. I've been reading a lot about the Great Depression, a time when they also had a, you know, generally very good guy in the White House, but without that kind of grassroots pressure, we wouldn't have won a lot of the achievements, progressive achievements that were made at that time 80 years ago. And we're going to need to get out there and organize like they did back then.
Stephen Lerner, finally, tell us a little bit more about the efforts by SEIU, the Take Back the Economy campaign, along with what you think people can do about pressuring for the Employee Free Choice Act that could mitigate through making unionizing easier, could mitigate some of these corporate excesses?
Well, on the Take Back the Economy, the demonstrations today around the country, again, people can go on the website.
Is it today or tomorrow, or is
tomorrow,
it both?
Tomorrow, mm-hmm. Sorry, tomorrow. It's takebacktheeconomy.org. What's been incredible is people are now setting up their own demonstrations, and it really seems to be catching fire. This is part of a broader work that we're doing to challenge all sorts of practices that are going on, and we really look at sort of there being three pillars here. One is we have to have health care reform, and many of these corporations that we're bailing out, we then subsidize because we provide health insurance through taxpayer dollars for their employers. They then get multiple subsidies because people get food stamps. So we're saying we need to cut out the subsidies to these companies that in turn crash the economy we're bailing out. Second, we really need to sort of to crack down on the practices of how they get workers deeper and deeper debt. This is a whole question of the abuse of credit cards, the ATM fees, everything they do to get deeper and deeper in their pockets. So there's a whole package of reforms of how to take force the financial industry to stop cheating people on a day-to-day basis. And on the Employee Free Choice Act, it's been introduced. It's a law that would very simply say that when a majority of workers want a union, the employer can't interfere, and then they would have to negotiate. We need to put pressure on every senator to vote this bill and to pass it, because it's the first step in how workers gain the power to really start changing conditions at the workplace and rebuild the middle class in this country.
Well, Stephen Lerner, Sarah Anderson, thank you both very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Stephen Lerner, Special Assistant to SEIU President Andy Stern, and Sarah Anderson, Director of the Global Economy Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. We've been talking about the executive compensation packages to AIG executives. That interview with Sarah Anderson and Stephen Lerner aired on March 18, 2009. When we come back, Robert Wiseman on the auto industry. After that, the role of the financial media in the recession. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We turn next to an interview about the auto industry and how it's getting treated very differently from the financial institutions.
In speaking to reporters yesterday at the White House, President Barack Obama announced the need for immediate restructuring to save the American auto industry. The president's statements came a day after he asked General Motors Chief Executive Officer Rick Wagoner to resign. After the auto corporation led by Wagoner failed to submit adequate restructuring plans in order to receive more federal money, Obama responded, the U.S. government has no interest or intention of running GM. With Chief Operating Officer Fritz Henderson as the new CEO, the White House is demanding the corporation financially restructure within 60 days. Obama stated, quote, it will require unions and workers who have already made painful concessions to make even more. It will require creditors to recognize that they cannot hold out for the prospect of endless government bailouts. Chrysler, another troubled automaker, is set to receive $6 billion from the government to finalize a negotiated deal with Fiat, an Italian automaker, within 30 days. If the two companies fail to come to terms, Chrysler is not expected to receive further help from the government, leaving for the probability of a complete sell-off. Joining me on the line this morning is Robert Wiseman. He is the editor of the National Monitor. Welcome to Uprising, Robert.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So first, explain why there's such a difference in how President Obama is handling banks and the insurance company AIG versus the auto companies. Both of these are industries that are failing and are getting federal help. So why this strong demand to have a proper plan and to financially restructure with the auto industry?
There's a story that you can tell, which is the one the administration apparently likes, which is that the financial system is so central to the working of the overall economy, so systemically important, not just that the financial institutions are systemically important to the rest of the financial system, but the financial system overall is systemically important to the working of the economy, that you have to figure out a way to keep it viable, plowing ahead, and support it, however. And the auto industry, while it's very important, isn't so central to the economy. So that's a story. I think that story is totally 100% implausible and wrong, and not an explanation for why there's the differential treatment. A different story is that Detroit, while once dominant in Washington, has seen its political power ebb as its economic power has fallen. So as its market share has declined, so has its market share of political power. It spent less money in Washington, less influential, less involved with the think tanks, less involved in shaping ideas. By contrast, Wall Street has invested $5 billion in Washington. The political process over the last 10 years is massively involved in the business of ideas in Washington, sends its people to staff the Treasury Department. People at the Treasury understand the way Wall Street works, think like Wall Street thinks, put themselves in the shoes of Wall Street, and they're getting much more sympathetic treatment as a result. I think that's the only realistic explanation for what's going on.
And there's another difference. The auto industry employs millions of unionized workers.
Yeah, I think that's right. So the guys in the Treasury Department can imagine themselves in the shoes of the Wall Street executives. They can't imagine themselves in the shoes of the auto industry executives, but it's beyond the pale to imagine themselves as auto workers.
So what do you think of this action by the president that he is demanding this restructuring? He's taking a very active role, but he is also suggesting short-term bankruptcy as a way for these companies to get out of the situation they're in. First, just on its own, is that a good idea?
Well, on the bankruptcy issue, I'm pretty skeptical. They think that they can manage a bankruptcy with guarantees to consumers so that there won't be too much harm done to the underlying brands. I think that's a pretty big risk and undesirable. Now, we also don't know if they're actually serious about pushing bankruptcy or if they just need to seem serious about pushing bankruptcy to force changes at GM and Chrysler.
So what sort of changes could these two companies do? GM has been given 2 months, Chrysler only 1 month to make a deal with Fiat, as I mentioned. What would be adequate, first, from the president's perspective, and second, from the perspective of really having long-term stability? Those two may coincide, but they may not.
Yeah, that's right. I think there are two things. There are two primary goals, and I think the material that's out from the Obama administration suggests their emphasis is on market viability while they're also paying attention to ecological sustainability. And I think the public interest is in the reverse. You can't have the companies continue if they're not ultimately going to be viable. But the most important thing is trying to deal with climate change and its relationship to the auto industry. What they are saying is that the plan from General Motors does not see the company becoming hitting a break-even point within a five-year window, and even with all the various cost cuts they propose. And so from the point of view of the administration, they're not cutting enough, and something else has to be done. So they're pushing them to make additional cuts. They want more concessions from the workers. I think it's deeply problematic. They want clearer concessions from GM's creditors, which makes sense. They want a better indication of how GM is going to shed different product lines and deal with its dealers, which probably makes sense. In the case of Chrysler, they're saying they've made a determination the company is not going to be viable on its own, and they're telling them they have to basically hook up with Fiat in the next 30 days or call it quits.
Now, you said more concessions from workers. Let's talk a little bit about that. The recent controversy that blew up last week over the bonuses paid to AIG executives was brought attention in terms of hearings on Congress. And some people were comparing that to how UAW workers, United Auto Workers, who represent many auto workers in Detroit, how these workers were treated in contrast. It's interesting reading that ABC News is reporting that Rick Wagoner, the CEO who was essentially forced out by the Obama administration, is walking out with a $20 million retirement package, which, of course, even though he is being told he was responsible and is being pushed out, he faces a very comfortable future, whereas auto workers are being asked to make even more concessions.
Well, for Wagoner, I think that's breaking news, and it's a little bit unclear because there were also reports that they wanted to actually keep him on at his current salary, which is $1 a year, to avoid paying him the severance pay. So we'll see how that plays out.
Okay.
That was quite an attractive approach, I thought. I thought it was very good that they removed the management at GM. They told the CEO, Rick Wagoner, he's got to go. It, again, as you're pointing out, it contrasts very starkly to how they've to the kid glove treatment for the financial sector. But there's a more serious issue that you're raising with the treatment of the AIG bonuses versus the line workers represented by United Auto Workers at General Motors and Chrysler. The out-of-the-box line from the administration on why they couldn't deal with the bonus problem was that contracts have to be respected. Now, here we're talking about the administration forcing the renegotiation of already renegotiated concessional contracts with the auto workers. And really, if they are at all serious about trying to cut costs from the worker side, they're talking about going against deeply settled expectation from workers that have existed for decades about the kind of health care coverage they're going to get from their employers and into retirement. So it is a much more severe ask of people who are much less well-positioned than was ever contemplated at AIG.
My guest is Robert Wiseman, the editor of the Multinational Monitor. We're talking about the auto industry and in particular GM and Chrysler that the Obama administration has taken a very intimate role in, recently forcing the CEO of GM to resign and giving both companies deadlines until which they have to meet in order to restructure themselves financially. Let me come back to what I'd asked you earlier, which is what specifically could these companies do to restructure themselves financially, not just in terms of creating products that are more sensitive to climate change, better hybrid cars, et cetera, more fuel efficient cars, but also financially restructuring in terms of the CEOs versus the workers? There was a conversation around healthcare because of the number of workers that these companies employ and the fact that there is a legitimate drain on the resources of these companies because of the fact that the government does not pay for health care. Can you comment on that and what the Obama administration could do to alleviate that?
Well, it is true that the GM and Chrysler, as well as Ford, have significant what are called legacy costs, is different from the legacy assets of the financial industry, which are the health care monies owed to retired workers. So they're paying for health care for workers who've retired after 30 years of service to the companies. And health care is obviously extremely expensive. Those are employees who are expensive to insure because they're older. And if there was a government insurance program, a single payer, Medicare for all, they would come off of the books of GM and Chrysler and Ford and would be part of the overall national system, and there would be no disadvantage that these companies have as against the Japanese manufacturers and others who do not have those kind of costs. The Japanese manufacturers, of course, although they do have substantial manufacturing capacity now in the United States, are relatively new with their factories, so don't have these older retired workers that they're paying for, and of course also don't have unionized workers that they're responsible for. But it should be said that there's a massive exaggeration about the cost of employees in the overall cost structure of the auto industry. The wages and benefits for existing employees is less than 10% of the cost of a car. So no matter what kind of concessions they make, that's not going to get costs down. And moreover, cost is not the ultimate problem. It's not the primary problem facing the auto industry right now. The primary problem is that demand has fallen off a cliff. And that has nothing to do with the auto industry, however incompetent GM may have been and it has been. That's completely beyond their control.
It's just that the economy is failing. People have less cash to spare and are fearful of spending any that they do have.
Yeah, I mean, the overall demand for cars has dropped by a third or 40% in the last year, so no industry can deal with that in the short term. And there is probably some extent to which the financial industry is directly responsible because it is harder for people to get car loans right now. Well, I think much more serious is the overall collapse of the economy.
Robert, let's talk a little bit about how this news of the Obama administration's role in the auto industry is being met by, or how it's being critiqued by mainstream media and conservative media in particular. There's always this specter of socialism. We've discussed it on this program quite a bit. Now there's a fear because of the active role the Obama administration has been taking that the government wants to nationalize the auto industry. How legitimate are those fears?
It's hard to even know how to answer such a silly premise now.
The government
is dominant in the national economy right now. The giant financial companies exist only because, outside of bankruptcy, only because of this massive infusion from the federal government. All kinds of hidden guarantees, including more than $250 billion guaranteed directly at Citigroup, the Federal Reserve pumping in several trillion dollars into financial institutions in different markets. So the government is keeping the economy afloat right now, and that's just how it is. And the criticism or these kind of silly remarks are coming about in the case of General Motors only because the government is doing what it should be doing in the financial sector, which is to say, if the taxpayers are going to be putting all this money on the line, they ought to be demanding some quid pro quos, and they ought to be demanding some kind of accountability, and they ought to be demanding changes to support, to alter the way firms operate so that they're viable going forward into the future.
I want to play an excerpt of a discussion on Fox News' America's Newsroom just yesterday about the GM CEO being forced to resign.
The government is going to tell you who you can fire, how much you can pay them, the perks that they can receive, their business practices, and basically what product you can put out. History.
Sounds like oversight 100% of the way.
Yeah,
when you think about, too, the White House sending its own team to Detroit to oversee the new restructuring. These companies are not going to make a move unless the White House gives them the thumbs up.
No, the government now controls the car industry in the United States.
That's a discussion on Fox News just yesterday. Robert Wiseman, your comments.
Well, the alternative to the government exercising some control and offering the money is that the companies go into bankruptcy. So not only is that a worse option for the companies, what happens in bankruptcy? A bankruptcy judge controls the companies and makes decisions about what they can do. So there's no escape. I mean, if you're a big company and you mess up so badly that you are no longer solvent, unless you were Wall Street and have the ability to extract massive amounts of cash from the federal government with no quid pro quo, you're going to come under the control of the government, either in the form of the kind of government oversight that we're seeing now from the executive branch or government oversight that you're going to get in the face of bankruptcy.
So, Robert, finally, on the one hand, it seems as though these auto industries very sort of crucial to the American economy if you're looking specifically at jobs and decent jobs. But then on the other hand, the demand has fallen off. It's, you know, from the using the premise of how a company would operate in this capitalist system, this would mean ordinarily a downsizing. What do you recommend needs to happen, both from the perspective of what government should do and from the perspective of how the economy needs to survive and how this industry itself needs to survive? What do you think could be the best case scenario from the perspective of jobs, the products being produced, and taxpayers' money that is going to bail these companies out?
Well, I think that's exactly the right question. And to its credit, it's a question the Obama administration is asking with this industry that it's not asking with Wall Street. It is not necessarily obvious for people who live on the East or West Coast how central the auto industry is to the overall national economy and just crucial to communities throughout the Midwest. So the industry, I do believe, really needs to be saved. Everything has to be done to mitigate the layoffs, some of which are going to be inevitable, but to keep the industry as viable as possible. Now, going forward, we know what we need from our transportation sector. We're going to need transformative technologies, transitioning with electric car, you know, with hybrid cars and much more fuel-efficient cars, but going to carbon-free cars in the near-term future. We need much more investment in public transit. And I believe that the government ought to be saying, those are the plans that we want to see coming from you. We want to see how you're going to respond to those overarching social needs, and that is our priority demand from you. You have to do that. You've got to do that in an efficient way, but we're not going to ask you to show returns or, you know, return to viability measured as profitability in the course of 1, 2, or 3 years. We want to see a plan for massive new investment in capital, infrastructure, and in design so that we've got a sustainable transportation sector going forward, and we've got an industry that's able to supply the transportation needs of the country in the decades ahead.
Well, Robert Wiseman, as always, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Hope to have you back on in the future.
Thanks so much for having me on.
That interview with Robert Wiseman aired on March 31st, 2009. After this short break, we'll come back with a conversation about the financial news and its collusion in the economic crisis. This is Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We now end the show with a rebroadcast of a recent interview with Media Matters about the financial news media. U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner announced yesterday a new $1 trillion plan to purchase toxic assets from failing banks. According to Geithner, the newest bailout is designed to generate investment. However, Nobel Prize-winning economist and New York Times columnist Paul Krugman sharply criticized the plan, saying that it will be ineffectual. President Obama's key economic advisor, Christina Romero, responded publicly in the media, disagreeing with Krugman about the joint public-private sector plan, while expressing confidence that the U.S. economy will show discernible signs of recovery in 12 months. With the economy constantly in the news, from AIG's controversial bonuses to the latest bailout plan, Media Matters has launched a new project to keep financial news accountable. The longtime watchdog group recently introduced the Financial Media Matters website that will monitor economic misinformation disseminated in major outlets such as the Wall Street Journal, CNBC, and Fox Business News. Now joining me from Washington, D.C. is Carl Frisch. He is a senior fellow at Media Matters for America. Welcome to Uprising, Carl.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Now, it's interesting because the recent Jon Stewart interview on The Daily Show with CNBC's Jim Cramer, I think, has helped bring into public consciousness the role that financial media has played in the recession. Let's talk a little bit about who are the financial media first. I mean, supposedly they're people with a background in economics, right?
Supposedly. Although Media Matters did a study a couple weeks ago that showed that in something like 600 news segments about the economic crisis, only, I believe, 6% of those broadcasts contained comments from an economist. So,
But what about those doing the interviewing?
Well, very few of those doing the interviewing. What's more likely that you'll find on Fox Business News or Fox Business Network or CNBC is the person doing the interviewing is more likely to have ties to the industry than they are to be an actual economist.
And therein lies the problem?
It's a big problem. I don't think that it's necessarily a problem. If you look at political journalism, for instance, many political journalists have some kind of political experience. I think it has the ability to make one a better reporter. Now, the problem comes in, and I think if people remember the Jon Stewart interview, when Jon Stewart, basically started talking about the journalistic abilities of CNBC, Cramer shot back, "Look, we interviewed these people and they lied to us." Well, any reporter worth their weight, worth their weight, is going to go after more than just the word of a CEO who stands to benefit from their report. They're going to dig deeper. They're going to check and see if what the CEO is saying is actual truth, or if it's, just spin.
And I've
been doing that.
Unlike Pacifica, these financial news outlets have armies of staff to do that kind of background checking and have,
right,
have enough money to do it.
It's like watching Entertainment Tonight, but for the financial industry.
So how did, specifically, what role did outlets like CNBC and Wall Street Journal play? I mean, this is the obvious question, but,
sure,
but specifically, was it just their cheerleading of the, the time when the housing bubble was just getting bigger and bigger? Was it their cheerleading and the lack of reporting on the reality that led to this problem?
Well, I think we have a very short memory when it comes to these types of events. CNBC in particular faced enormous scrutiny, not just right now, when the tech bubble was bursting. They faced scrutiny for hyping stocks that were going belly up during Enron. They faced the same scrutiny. So now here we are again. This type of reporting. You hear things like this on CNBC. Quote, "Too much is being made of both the subprime credit problem and the housing downturn," end quote. Or, quote, "The recession debate is over. It's not going to happen. Time to move on." Or, "There's no recession coming. The pessimists were wrong. It's not going to happen." Or, "We are in a slow patch. That's all. It's nothing to get us up in arms about." Or, "The reality is a possible upturn in the housing trend, and at the very least, we are getting a bottom." So it was cheerleading. And that's not the role of a journalist. That's the role of the people within the company. It's the job of the journalist to look and see, them leveraging their finances 35-1 a good idea? No, it's not a good idea, especially when many economists were seeing the housing bubble coming to an end or bursting. Years ago, as far back as 2002, as Dean Baker pointed out in 2002, once the subprime mortgage crisis hit, it was only a matter of time before other people started losing their homes, which was going to lead to economic catastrophe.
Now, there's on that issue itself, certainly there was a cheerleading, but also, as the Jim Cramer interview with Jon Stewart points out, these interviewers, these reporters in the financial media very much legitimized, if you will, the betting on the hedge funds and the mortgage-backed securities.
As if it was just a game.
Mm-hmm. And so just basically encouraging, Wall Street executives to continually bet on essentially what was going to harm ordinary people and making money off of the backs of ordinary people.
Profit at any cost. that, you know, sure, that's what corporate America wants, but that's not the job of the media.
But again, that's the heart of this whole media infrastructure,
right?
That is has a massive pro-business slant, because the people who are in it, Jim Cramer himself has his own hedge funds.
Right.
It's like Wall Street reporting on Wall Street.
Which is why we launched financialmediamatters.org. Because all of these problems, the scapegoat here is that the folks at CNBC and NBC claim that progressives and people concerned are trying to use CNBC as the big excuse. That's not the case. They are not the only problem here. They are one big problem, and they fail to realize that. And that's why we've launched Financial Media Matters. We need people looking much more closely at what is happening on CNBC, what is happening on Fox Business Network and Bloomberg and in the Wall Street Journal and in the monthly financial publications, because they're not going to police themselves. And if we've learned anything in this crisis, it's that only by average American citizens who consume the news holding their media accountable is anything going to, better going to come out of this.
And certainly these news outlets didn't interview, people like Dean Baker and Doug Henwood, Naomi Prinz, so many of these trained economists who were sounding the alarm. My guest is Carl Frisch, a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, progressive media watchdog, research and information center based in Washington, D.C. He's talking to us about a new campaign that his group has launched, financialmediamatters.org. So now I understand Financial Media Matters wrote an open letter about CNBC host Larry Kudlow. Tell us about that letter.
Well, Larry Kudlow has had his own show on CNBC for quite some time, and as of late, he's taken to criticizing Senator from Connecticut as well as other Democratic leaders. He's scheduled to raise money for the National Republican Congressional Campaign Committee, and to make matters worse, it's one thing to report on things. It's another thing to be weighing a possible Senate campaign against that very senator he's been criticizing. So he's been using his airwaves to possibly enhance his prospects as a candidate for Senate, and that's just unethical by any standard. It's similar to what we saw when Chris Matthews was looking at running for Senate as a Democrat in Pennsylvania, when he would have on Ed Rendell and other prominent Democrats from Pennsylvania and just, completely inflate their egos. So what we've done is we've written an open letter that people can see at financialmediamatters.org to CNBC, asking that they force Kudlow's hand, make him make a decision. If he chooses to run for the Senate, he should be forced to take a leave of absence from the network.
Now, Carl, it's not just CNBC and the Wall Street Journal, et cetera. It's also the right-wing media. It's also
Absolutely.
The shock jocks. Now, tell us about a little bit about the role that Rush Limbaugh, who I'm not sure how much he knows about economics, but what role has he been playing, cheerleading before the recession and now in the wake of it, cheerleading the Wall Street execs?
Well, it's quite funny. Rush Limbaugh, just last week, and we monitor him every day on his show at limbaughwire.com. He was likening people's criticism of AIG to an angry lynch mob that was being ginned up by the Obama administration. And then after he said that, all the little Limbaughs in the media started following suit, including Glenn Beck from Fox, who also called it a lynch mob, which I found very funny. This is the same guy who has taken to broadcasting on Fridays from a doom room where he hosts survivalists prophesizing the impending doom of our country. It's also the same guy who claims that the White House is using FEMA to set up concentration camps for conservatives in an effort to establish totalitarian rule.
Wow.
Which, in fairness to him, he's not saying that he's sure about this. He's just saying his, quote, research hasn't disproven it yet. Mm. Which, I guess if anybody knows how to incite an angry, irrational, conspiracy-prone mob, it would be Glenn Beck.
Now, Carl, the Wall Street execs have their media, and certainly the right wing has its media. But what about what about the reporting on the silent majority, the masses of Americans who are up in arms about, what they're seeing happening, not only on Wall Street, but in the government handouts? Now, there was a lot of reporting reporting on the public outrage and the public outcry over the AIG bonuses. Do you think that the media in general, not just the financial media, but the media in general, did a decent job of expressing that public outrage?
Absolutely not. You know, one reason we're not limiting financialmediamatters.org to only financial publications is because many Americans do get their financial news, their economic news, their labor news, from traditional, you know, papers like their local paper or the Washington Post and the New York Times. So Financial Media Matters will also focus on those issues from those publications and other networks. It's important, you know, to realize that the corporate media does not only report drivel. They don't always mess it up. Unfortunately, you have to really have a good eye for finding a good story.
And you have to be an expert in economics yourself. You can't rely on them to emphasize
what's
important.
Is what a lot of people just don't have time for, and that's why Media Matters exists. What you need to do is, if you're reading something, you need to read it in another outlet as well. Go on the blogs and, you know, don't trust everything you read, whether it's in the blogs or whether it's, you know, in a traditional news outlet, but read enough to where you're getting a well-rounded view of what's going on out there. And then take your what you've learned and go to MediaMatters.org. You're likely to find every day we're posting research on what's happening in the news, correcting common misinformation, correcting misstatements of fact. And then you can take that knowledge that you've gleaned from the traditional media and the blogosphere, and you can read our items, and you'll have a pretty good idea of what's happening out there. Failing that, if you don't have time to do all that, you can just read MediaMatters.org, and we do a pretty good job of summarizing every day what's happening out there and correcting what's not accurate.
Carl, how has the mainstream media in general created a sympathy, if you will, for example, the AIG executives who received the millions of dollars in bonuses? And in general, you know, you hear about, you heard some of AIG's top people talking about the death threats that their people have received. What sort of, how sympathetic has the coverage been to humanize these extremely wealthy people?
Well, I mean, let's be clear. Death threats under any circumstances are not appropriate. I understand the anger.
People have committed suicide who have lost their homes and their jobs. You know,
their jobs, or they're working multiple jobs just to keep their head above water, and they have been doing that for more than a decade. Times are awful out there. They're not just tough. They're terrible. So I understand the anger. I don't think, aside from the talk about the death threats, I don't think you've seen much to humanize the executives in the traditional press. In the conservative press, you obviously have. And it's not so much a effort on their part to humanize them, but it's an effort to dehumanize those who have less than. And that's something that's ongoing in the conservative media at all times.
And that's part of that, we shouldn't be rewarding people who made bad decisions, implying that those
bad
are got subprime mortgages.
Lazy, mm-hmm. You know, if they weren't late, you know, just as an example, Neil Bortz, who's a conservative talk radio host, one of the top talkers in this country, said yesterday that anybody who makes under $75,000 a year is just lazy.
Okay, well, yeah. I guess I joined those ranks, certainly.
I guess he doesn't know what the median income in this country is. Like, we all can't be paid like a talk show host.
Mm. Well, Carl, I want to thank you very much for joining us, and certainly listeners can check out financialmediamatters.org to read your and others' articles at that website. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Carl Frisch is a senior fellow at Media Matters for America, Progressive Media Watchdog Research and Information Center in Washington, D.C. Again, that new the website for the new campaign is financialmediamatters.org. That interview with Carl Frisch aired on March 24, 2009. That does it for today's show. Tomorrow, more of the best of our recent economic coverage. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's program, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online at pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. You can hear an audio stream of this program after 10 a.m. today on our website, kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening, and see you tomorrow at 8.